Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name's Kirk Chisholm, and I'm going to be your host. Today we have a special guest, Chris Mackey, and we're going to be talking about global trade, tax policy, and private equity. So before you go to sleep, let's hear from Chris. How are you doing today, Chris?
Oh, I'm doing very well. It's great to be with you and your listeners to talk about these exciting subjects. All kidding aside, these have a big impact on investing.
One of the reasons we wanted to bring Chris on is because there's obviously a lot of talk with China and trade wars, and I couldn't imagine a better guest to bring on to talk about it than Chris. So this actually is not going to be a boring episode. This is going to be pretty exciting because as you listen to the news, you get maybe a misconception of what's going on. And you hear from the left and the right, and you hear all these different points of view and how what Trump's doing is good, what he's doing is bad. And a lot of people have political bents to their views. And we want to bring on Chris. He's really not political in nature, and he's really kind of looking at this from an innovative standpoint of how we can look at some of these bigger issues from a kind of an outside perspective, and let's come up with some other solutions. So Chris, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about your background and where you're coming from your perspective?
Sure. Well, most importantly is what you mentioned. I do come from a non-political background. I'm a finance guy. I'm not associated with a political party or a super PAC or a lobbyist or anything else. I'm just a guy who's worked in finance for about 27 years, working firsthand with companies, seeing what drives job growth, what drives expansion, location decisions, you know, where do they open and close plants, what drives wage growth. And part of my focus in writing the book Solutionomics was to apply ROI or return on investment to come up with a blueprint or a business plan for America for achieving its economic potential. So you're right. When I look at global trade, I look at it from a very objective ROI perspective, not a political perspective.
So when you say ROI, explain that for the listeners.
It's simply the idea of making decisions based on your return on investment. Now, typically, your investors will be thinking of that in the context of an investment in whether it's stocks or bonds or something else. In the context of Solutionomics, the book, it's really in the context of policy. If we're going to have a trade policy and we're going to impose tariffs, not impose tariffs, whatever the case may be, let's judge it based on the economic impact or the return on the investment that we're making. I mean, right now, for example, we are in a sense making an investment through the tariffs, you can agree or disagree, that is costing certain parts of our country. Let's take the dairy farmers. And that is an investment in what we hope, or the president hopes, would be better trade terms. So that's what I mean by that, as opposed to, well, it's going to benefit this side or that side or the special interest group. It's about economics and investment.
We live in a capitalist society. Isn't everything looking at return on investment? Aren't we trying to maximize our return on investment? Or how do you kind of square that?
Well, let me tell you a quick story. So I was in D.C. on the Hill, and I was talking with a congressional staffer, and I was talking with them about the idea of corporate tax policy. And the specific idea was, look, let's base each company's tax rate on each company's rate of job growth, wage growth, and the percentage of jobs that they have in America. The idea being that the companies that are creating the jobs and paying higher wages and keeping a larger portion of their employees here in the U.S., that they would pay a lower tax rate than, say, companies that were moving jobs overseas and taking productive capacity out of the U.S. She looked at me with a very forlorn face and said, they just don't think that way. So yes, that would be the ideal. And investors and your listeners look at it that way. But unfortunately, in Congress, they don't look at it that way. And that's part of the reason why I took the time to write the book, was to lay out a blueprint to say, hey, we need to start thinking about these things differently for the benefit of the American taxpayer.
What's really confusing for most people, I mean, most people don't have an accounting background or a finance background. So a lot of this stuff kind of goes over people's heads. I mean, you get these big issues that I'm not sure there's really a one-size-fits-all solution, because anytime you change tax policy, there are winners and there are losers. It's a zero-sum game. There's only so much money to go around. So how do you look at it so that you're able to solve this problem, because there's always going to be losers when you change the tax code?
Well, the first thing to identify is, who is it that you're making these so-called investments on behalf of, in this case, it's the taxpayer. And so that's the first thing is, so talk about the losers and the winners. You want to focus on the taxpayer. And so the investment, when you're talking about tax cuts, is the government is taking in less money and therefore is borrowing money, which the American taxpayer will eventually have to repay at some point. Now, just like in any other investment, in return for that borrowing, you should get some type of return. When it comes to corporate tax policy and you're cutting tax rates, the return should be an increase in the number of jobs and increase in wages. Those are two of the primary things that you should get. So the investment is lower tax revenue, borrowing more, and hopefully getting more jobs and higher wages. And the way that you ensure that is you create an incentive for companies so that if they do hire more, if they do increase wages, if they do keep more of their employment in the U.S., then they pay a lower tax rate. And conversely, the companies that may actually be reducing their employment, moving operations overseas, they wouldn't get that same tax benefit, which means you would then have an incentive for more jobs, which benefits the American taxpayer or their return on their investment.
That certainly makes sense. When you kind of look at, let's say, the last 10 years, and there really hasn't been much wage growth. One of the big signs of inflation is wage growth, and I think people have been concerned that that has not. Asset prices have gone up, but wage growth hasn't. Even though we have the lowest unemployment ever, or however you want to calculate it. I mean, I'm not going to argue with statistics, but generally speaking, if it's not the lowest ever, it's definitely up there. So I guess the question is, why don't we have more wage growth if we have this low unemployment? Wages should be going up right now.
You're exactly right. That is what the theory says. What happens is that back in, you know, right around 2000, China joined the World Trade Organization, which basically meant that they were let into the global business community on very different terms. At the time, I think there were 980 million working age people in China. You know, the U.S. has maybe 240 million people that are 18 years or older. So we dumped about a billion additional people into the labor pool. Now, that can be a good thing because they can be consumers. And that was the theory. But the problem is, well, U.S. consumers spend about 95 cents of every dollar that they make, which generates demand and generates jobs. The Chinese consumer only spends about 60 cents. And so what happened was we flooded the labor market with additional workers, but we did not increase consumption at the same rate. And so you've got an imbalance between the amount of labor that's available and the purchasing power, which impacts investment. So basically what happened is the unemployment rate's low. A lot of people have jobs, but because there's so many alternatives to find cheaper labor elsewhere, that means that employees don't have the same leverage to be able to have higher wages. And that's one reason why that happened. There's also automation. That's another impact that has happened as well. But automation should be good because that increases productivity. But basically, just think of it this way. We significantly increased the competition for jobs, and that is what has been holding back a part of what has been holding back wage growth, which is why if you say to companies, look, if you're paying among the highest wages in your industry, and if you're increasing wages, we're going to provide a tax cut. And for those that don't, you won't get that. That's how you drive, or you help to provide an incentive for wage growth. What the Tax Cut and Jobs Act did was it said, okay, every company gets a tax cut. You can fire Americans, you can reduce wages, you can pay the lowest wages in the industry, and you're still going to get a tax cut. That's actually not good for investors because that means there is an incentive, is not an incentive for consumers to make more money, which would enable them to buy more goods, which would require an increase in investment, which would be good for investors because there'd be more investment opportunities.
One of the things that I've been always fascinated with is Japan, right? We go into a recession. We typically, in the U.S., we fire employees. We cut costs and fire people. In Japan, they didn't do that. They didn't fire people. They just collectively, as a country, as a culture, they just accepted lower wages. I can't say if that's what's causing their deflation or not, but certainly big global elements like you're talking about with China are causing some issues here locally. But hopefully that they're buying more stuff, or we're buying more stuff from them, because we also have abundance. I remember growing up, you know, the toilet plunger breaks and you just tape it up and you keep using it. Nowadays, you get a scratch on it, you throw it away and get another one. It's cheap. But now it's just, there's an abundance of everything. People have too much stuff. There's just way too much stuff. So
if I could just build on your point there. So you talked about Japan, and that's very true. What happens, free market system, and we're able to lay off people and get staffing in line with demand. Whereas in Japan, it's a different approach. It's also an issue with China, which is, think about this. The companies that the U.S. is competing with in China, what they call the state-owned enterprises, U.S. companies are trying to compete with them in these state-owned enterprises, which are a significant number. I mean, let me give you just one stat here. 47 of the 106 owned state-owned enterprises, 47 of those in China would be in the global Fortune 500 list. These are massive companies. Now, if you take away the government subsidies, estimates are that their returns are minus 6%. So what that means is that they can basically subsidize the companies. They can subsidize the company's employees, keeping wages down. And so what that means is then we are forced to deal with those low wages. They don't buy as much. They're overproducing. They're dumping their goods on the rest of the world because they're not consuming everything to the magnitude that they should be. And that's part of what contributes to the wage growth, similar to what you were talking about, or lack of wage growth, similar to what you were talking about with Japan. It's very difficult when you're dealing with a non-capitalist competitor that is subsidizing their companies, in effect, keeping their wages low.
So basically what you're saying is the government subsidies are keeping these down. That's really the crux of the problem.
That's a significant part of it. If you've got a competitor and they've got a rich uncle and the rich uncle just keeps lending them money, even though your competitor is losing money, it's going to be really hard for you to be successful if you're driven by the profit motive, because you got to have a certain price for your product to earn a decent return, and they don't. And so then that also means that you can't pay as much to your employees because you're competing against this other company that's basically a money-losing operation.
The China issue I find to be really interesting, because I read a lot about China and different perspectives, and I get the feeling that most of what I read are from people who really don't understand China. Like, they're looking at China from the U.S. lens. They're looking at it with a lens on our culture. Like, they're supposedly living up to our cultural standards when they're a completely different culture with completely different standards. And we're trying to analyze them like it'll be easy. They'll just do X and it'll solve our problem. But they don't. They're completely different. They have different opinions on private property. They have different opinions on state subsidies. They do a lot of that. What do you see as some of the major issues with China right now? Because we're in a trade war with them, if you want to call it a trade war. But you're in this trade war with China, and obviously things haven't gotten fixed yet. So what do you see as some of the major challenges?
One of the first things is that there are what I call 12 global trade myths. And these are myths or ideas that we have based our trade policy on, which just aren't true. They're just myths. And, you know, one of those ties directly to China, which is the idea, the myth that all countries want free and open trade. No, what countries want is they want an advantage for their country. And that's very natural. And we want an advantage in our country. But when you have that belief that every country has the same objective that we do, which is free and open trade, because that creates greater economic wealth for everybody, but you're dealing with a competitor that is playing for a very different set of rules to try and gain an advantage, you're going to come out on the losing side. So 13 of the 15 largest countries we traded with sold more goods to us than we did to them. If we were an NFL team, that would mean we had a dismal 2 wins, 13 losses. That's not acceptable. Part of the reason why that's occurring is because we have these ideas or these myths that are incorrect. And one of them is that China wants free and open trade. And they certainly don't want free and open trade. They want to benefit from trade just like we should. Now, here's the thing. Global trade done right is the best scenario for America. And what I mean by done right is winning the game of global trade. And that starts by having reciprocal trade terms. I'm not even talking punitive. I'm talking reciprocal. You know, when we're dealing with China, let me give you an example. Up until recently, they had a 25% tariff on our vehicles. We had a 2.5% tariff on theirs. That seems a little unfair and is going to put us at a disadvantage. And there's a reason why General Motors, is making cars in China and exporting them back to the U.S. because we don't have much of a tariff. And so they can go over there, make the cars cheaper, and then sell them back here while they talk about not having or having too much capacity here. So that's one of the differences, is we have unequal tariffs. Another is the intellectual property. So the U.S. is the leader in intellectual property. Now, China's rapidly catching up with their technology, and part of the reason that they're catching up is that they're doing what are called forced transfers. So they're saying, look, if you want to sell goods in China, you have to share your technology with us. That really takes away a key competitive advantage for the U.S. You look at state subsidies to companies in China, you look at intellectual property that's being forcibly transferred. There are even requirements where they say if you want to sell goods in China, you have to make the goods in China. And you put some of these factors together, and those are the big issues that are trying to be resolved. And it's very likely that's not going to be resolved in the near term. Those are longer term issues.
From what I read, that intellectual property issue is not going to really be solved. They don't have the same views on property rights that we have, the way that I read it. I don't know how you solve that when culturally they look at it as, well, we'll just take the advantage when we can. I get it. If they're capitalists in some degree, then that's how they would look at it. But how do you solve some of these challenges when maybe a country doesn't view the rules the same as maybe we do?
Let's start with this. Tariffs are never the best first choice. That is not the first thing that you want to do. Even the great free trader, Adam Smith, said, there are situations where when another country is acting in a way that is so egregious or so unfair or uneven, you need to implement some type of reciprocal means. Now, let me give you the exact quote from The Wealth of Nations. Adam Smith said, talking about when other countries have significant tariffs on you, revenge in this case naturally dictates retaliation, and that we should impose the like duties and prohibitions upon importation of some or all of the manufactured goods, and I would say services, into ours. Again, this is a big free trader. I'm a supporter of global trade. The reality is, if they're trying to gain an advantage, we need to be trying to gain at least equal advantage. I'm not even talking about an advantage. I'm just talking about equality. And so if they're doing forced intellectual property transfers, then maybe it's time we have forced intellectual property transfers as well, and you use other mechanisms that make it very costly for them to continue to engage in those types of practices.
Let me ask this question, because you mentioned a very unbalanced tariffs, 2.5% versus 25. Why did the U.S. allow this to happen? Because this seems like this should have been solved long ago.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question, because it's so important for people to understand. So what I write about in the book is that simply trade policy was used as a tool in foreign policy. After World War II, we were engaged in a competition with communism, and we were trying to secure as many allies on the side of capitalism as we possibly could. Very important and very good objective. Part of how we did that through favorable trade terms, or let's say it this way, unequal trade terms. So we would allow other countries to have more favorable trade terms, which would give them an economic incentive to be economically aligned with us. Now, that certainly had foreign policy benefits, but it also had trade policy benefits. The other reason is that it seems like sometimes Congress doesn't understand that we still have the most affluent consumer market and business market in the world. It's a very, very desirable market. Every global company in the world needs to be in the U.S. That's something that we should be leveraging, that fact, to say, look, okay, you know, you've got forced tariffs, forced intellectual property, you're subsidizing your companies, this and that and the other. We really want a reciprocal or an equal environment so that you can have the access to the U.S. consumer that you want, which we want you to have, because that helps us to have lower cost goods as well. And we want to have equal terms so that we have equal access to your consumer, rather than this idea of, well, you know what, okay, maybe we'll just go along with that, and maybe we'll just trade this for some other foreign policy objective. That's basically why it happened. Trade policy was used in the service of foreign policy, and that's how we got some of these unequal deals, and it's time to change some of those. And again, just level up the playing field.
you know, the wall coming down with the Soviet Union changed a lot of things, but it didn't change this dynamic. China being, you know, a big competitor now, coming up to the world stage and challenging us for basically for the number one country in the world in terms of wealth and trade and all this. I think everyone sees them as a potential competitor, but at the same time, they also, they're welcoming them to take over. And I think everybody wants to win and everyone wants to get along. But at the same point, I kind of wonder when people are making these decisions, if they're really thinking strategically, because there's going to be huge implications for the global economy, because a lot of it's based on the U.S. So how do you look at that part of it?
The first step is education. Again, we've got these 12 global trade myths that we're basing our trade policy on, and that is always going to lead us to trade policy that's going to put us at a disadvantage. My whole objective is to win the game of global trade. And so that means continue engaging in global trade, but winning global trade. And it begins first by understanding these trade myths, because if you're basing a strategy on ideas that are just flat out wrong, you're not going to win. You're not going to get the outcome that you want. So that's the first step. We got to educate the people who are listening so that they know when they're voting, this helps them decide which members of Congress that they want. But again, you know, this is a, yes, we need the trade. Yes, can be the best scenario. But my idea is let's get better at it. We can do better. It's not eliminating the trade. It's saying we can do better at the trade. But it begins with the education.
So what are some of the other, not all of them, but some of the other trade myths that you wrote about in your book?
One of the most important trade myths is the idea that how expensive a good is to a consumer is based purely on the price. The reality is whether or not a good is expensive to a consumer, whether or not it's cheap, depends on both the cost of a good and the income of that consumer. So we talked about the fact that, you know, since the 70s, we just haven't seen the wage growth that we would have wanted to have seen. And so, yes, our air conditioners are cheaper. Our electronics are cheaper. However, we haven't had the wage growth that we need. And so that means that those goods actually aren't as quote unquote cheap as they may seem. Because I got to tell you, if you're the person who either lost your job or lost your job and had to take a much lower paying job, you know, maybe you go from a manufacturing job to a retail job, that little bit of decrease in the price of your TV, computer, or air conditioner is more than offset by the fact that you either don't have a job or you're getting paid a lot less than you used to. So that's one of the key things, is to understand that there is a cost beyond just the price of the good. Another one is the idea that it's okay if we send all of our jobs overseas, because not all of our jobs, we send our jobs overseas, a lot of them being lower skill, let's say jobs, maybe manufacturing jobs, because we're going to go ahead and we're going to retrain those individuals and we're going to get all the high-tech jobs. Let me let everybody listening right now know, China is rapidly advancing their technology. They built their first aircraft carrier. They are the leader in commercial drones. They are developing highways that where their vehicles are being fueled as they go along the highway. They are no longer, as I say, just making soccer balls and Barbie dolls. They're making advanced technology, and they have a very concerted plan to do that. So that means we're going to have more competition for those jobs. So the idea that we can just say, you know, these middle-skilled jobs, we can send those overseas, that's not necessarily a good idea, because we may not have the jobs to reemploy those people in the other jobs. I'll say one other thing. One of the other myths is that it's always okay, or we should always send jobs overseas if another country can make the goods cheaper. That is only true if the people who have lost those jobs can get another job that pays at least as much, if not more, than the job that was sent overseas. And I can tell you, for the middle skill worker, I'm not talking the lowest skill, I'm talking the middle skill worker. So these are people typically who do have a high school degree and they maybe have some college. That is not always the case. And so that's one of the other damaging myths, is that, if a country can make it cheaper, we should always have them make the cheaper. No, that only makes sense if you have enough jobs of equal pay for the people who no longer have those jobs. So those are a few of the myths.
There's a few topics that I don't know if you want to touch on, but there's this idea of automation and computers also taking jobs. And I know there was a time hundreds of years ago where people were worried about, you know, the printing press, and that would take jobs. And now people are worried about computers and automation taking jobs. And you have these ideas of universal basic income coming out and saying, oh, well, this will help because all the jobs will be gone to robots. And it kind of leads me to believe that that's a little bit short-sighted, because you'll always find other ways to find jobs, but you still have to retrain people. So it doesn't seem to me that there's a big push to retrain people. It seems like politicians are looking for an easier fix rather than more of a structural fix. Did you find that to be the case?
You hit the nail on the head. It's short-term thinking. They're looking for just the quick political fix as opposed to the actual structural fix. Part of the problem is that we've got very short-term thinking, and part of that comes from the fact that everybody's just looking at the next election and not the long term, and they don't have that long-term interest of the country at hand. And here's the thing. Automation is certainly also having an impact on, again, what I call these middle-skill jobs. You know, these are the jobs that are in the heartland. These are the jobs that are in, interestingly, some of the key political battleground states, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. Sometimes I hear people say, Chris, you don't understand. It's the automation that's getting rid of all the jobs. It's not the trade. You shouldn't worry about the trade. My point is, let's just say that the majority of the reduction in the middle skill jobs is due to automation. Let's just make that argument and let's all agree with that. Even if that's the case, that means that we should be doing even more to try and not have global trade taking more of the jobs overseas. If automation is making it worse, then my gosh, let's control what we can, which is providing incentives for companies to keep the jobs here, which again goes back to that corporate tax policy. Because here's the thing about global trade. Tariffs are not what you want to be your first choice. Sometimes you need to do them, and sometimes they have been successful. However, what you'd rather do is you'd rather use domestic policy, and specifically that corporate tax policy, to say, look, we're going to give you incentives to not only maintain your operations here, but to increase your operations here. Then you don't even have to deal with the trade war. Then it's just a domestic issue that helps create more jobs here in America and maintains more jobs in America, which, by the way, means you have stronger wage growth. One thing about the universal basic income, and I apologize, this is just so important. Universal basic income is a sign that the system is a failure. If you need to have universal basic income, something is not working, because what you would much prefer is that people were able to go out there and do an honest day's work, contribute to the economic productive capacity of the U.S., which is the key to our wealth, and get paid more than enough to live their life and to have a good future without the need for UBI. UBI is basically just another form of minimum wage. Not saying it's good or bad, just saying that something is not working. And what I do believe is that rather than providing a universal basic income, it would be ideal if we provided wages and jobs that made it so you didn't need the UBI.
I would agree. I think it sounds good in theory. A lot of people in Silicon Valley are coming up with this for the most part, and sounds good in theory, but in actuality, I think it's going to be damaging, because the way I look at it is, if you're giving everybody $1,000 a month, then all of a sudden you get inflation. Great. But now that $1,000 a month is worth less. So it's kind of not really solving the problem. It just kind of works itself through a capitalist system. But I wanted to touch on a few things. We're going to wrap it up here. Is the idea of private equity. I mean, private equity has had this really interesting tax structure for a while now. And Congress always talks about how they're going to do away with it and how it's unfair, but no one ever seems to do anything about it. So maybe you can talk a little bit about the issue and maybe some of the solutions that could solve that.
Certainly. So let me just say, first of all, private equity is not homogenous. There's all different types of private equity. There's private equity that provides very important capital to smaller companies to help them expand, which helps create jobs. Helps create some of the next great job creators of our country. But there's also private equity that takes a very different approach, which is that rather than providing expansion capital to help grow the company and as a result the economy, it's capital that is used to, think of it like a home equity loan. They go in to buy the company, they borrow money against the value of the company, and a chunk of that money goes into their pockets rather than into the business. But they both get taxed the same way. That's an inconsistency. And so one of the things that you do for a solution is, again, and I know I sound like a broken record, but this is just so fundamental, is you say, okay, we're going to make your tax rate based on your job creation. So if you're that private equity firm that is funding a company that's expanding and that company is hiring more people, then they should pay a lower tax rate than the private equity firm that is not doing that, and certainly not the private equity firm that is buying the company and then engaging in mass layoffs for that company. Because two very different things occurring there, and changing the corporate tax policy will take that into account so that the job creators are getting the preferential tax treatment.
Let me take the contrary side of this, because I think that what you're saying is really important, and I think it's a great idea. But if you take the other side of this, well, you're basically incentivizing people to create jobs. But our economy and capitalism, when it's working efficiently, of course, which I don't believe we truly have capitalism right now, it's some homogenized version of that. But there's what I believe is could happen is you have a lot of excess. And now all of a sudden you're incentivizing people to create jobs instead of cutting the waste, which of course you want these companies to operate and be profitable. Now you just have people there just to fill the roles so they can get better tax treatment. I'm not sure if that would cause a problem or not. Have you thought that through and what the implications could be for that?
I have thought that through, and the implications are that the number one thing that causes companies to hire and fire is demand. That's the number one thing. If you don't have more customers, you're not going to hire more people, and you actually may be forced to reduce the number of people on your staff. And conversely, if you've got increasing customers and increasing demand, then you are going to increase, you're going to make that decision to do that. What the corporate tax cuts that I'm proposing to do is they would bridge the gap between Democrats and Republicans. So Republicans say if you cut taxes, companies will increase hiring. You've got Democrats who are skeptical. What I'm saying is, okay, it's like what we call an earnout in finance. For those companies that actually increase hiring, yeah, well, they'll pay a lower tax rate. For those that don't, they won't. And so therefore, you're not wasting taxpayer dollars on tax cuts that aren't going to companies that aren't hiring. Because in the end, it's all going to come down to customer demand. And so that will deal with the issue that you brought up, which is a very valid one.
It's a great point. And I know this a speech where people get up and start hollering about the injustice of the world. But when you see companies like, I don't know if I want to name them, but certain larger companies out there, and they're paying very little to no tax. And they're making billions of dollars and they're paying almost no tax. And it just seems extremely unfair when other companies are paying higher taxes. I don't think anybody would argue the fact that we have maybe an imbalanced tax policy, but I'd have to think through the implications of this. But I'm curious, you think that this solution would solve some of those imbalances with the larger companies?
It certainly would, because what we've got is we have a very inefficient tax system. Companies making lots of profits, I'm not as worried about that as I am what kind of job creation are they doing. If I've got two companies and one company is making a lot of profits, but man, they are creating hundreds of thousands of jobs a year, and they are very good paying jobs. I'm much more interested in that and would allow them to pay a lower tax rate than the company that is not creating the jobs. So I'm more focused on what they're doing on the job creation side and what they're doing on the wage growth side than I am the profit side. Because again, you can have companies that make a lot of money that are also generating significant numbers of jobs, and they could pay a lower tax rate and taxes, and that could be good for the American taxpayer. The issue is when you're not getting the job growth, you're not getting the higher wages, they're paying below industry wages, and they're still not paying any taxes. So I focus more on what they're doing on the jobs and wage side than the profit side.
Just one more question, we can wrap it up. A lot of our country is made up of small to mid-sized businesses for jobs. How does this impact them? Have you looked at the impacts of the smaller businesses and how that would affect them?
Absolutely. I've tailored the policy specifically to keep them in mind. One of the suggestions is that when we are calculating each company's tax rate, you take into account what percentage of a company's employees are based in the U.S. versus outside the U.S. Well, that's naturally going to be beneficial for small businesses, because most small businesses aren't global and they have most of their operations in the U.S. So it would definitely disproportionately benefit them. And that's critical, because it's the small businesses that are the heart and soul of our economy. We need both small and big, but it's the small businesses And they are the ones that could be the next great large company of tomorrow, taking into account the fact that they have more of their employees based in the U.S. That helps them get to that next level.
I love this idea. I love the fact that you're thinking of innovative approaches to solve these problems, because I think one of the challenges that our country has is people make the decisions very binary. It either needs to be A or it needs to be B. And neither A nor B are the right answer almost ever. If you ever watch the news or some of these finance channels, they give you two solutions as if those are the
That's
only
right.
two solutions. There are millions of solutions, but somehow we only get fed two of them. So I think it's really important to think about these things and come up with these innovative ideas. So I really appreciate you writing this book and coming up with solutions that are outside the box, because I think that's how we really solve some of these problems over the longer term.
And I very much appreciate the opportunity to discuss them with you and your listeners. Thank you.
Where can people find out more about you and your book?
Well, the book is for sale on Amazon. I know that's a surprise. It's Solutionomics. You can follow my writings at solutionomics.org. Again, that's .org. And by the way, Solutionomics is spelled just two words, solution and then omics. And then if people want to follow me on Twitter, my handle is at Solutionomics.
Today's show covers a wide variety of economic topics, so I thought it'd be interesting to check out some key data points as the decade of the tens wraps up. I logged into Y Charts to create a few visuals on job data and consumer sentiment to see where we are at the moment, and I've added them to the show notes for your reference. Y Charts has an endless supply of economic data points, so it really was easy for me to evaluate how the unemployment landscape has changed over the last 10 years. One thing caught my eye, though, as I scanned through these data points, that despite the historically low unemployment rate, there are actually more job openings than job seekers, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. This is a big change from back in December of 2011, when there were 3.3 job seekers for every job opening. As the unemployment rate has decreased, consumer sentiment has steadily increased over the last 10 years. The unemployment has fallen all the way to 3.5%, which is the lowest point in the decade. I was pretty surprised to see that when analysts project a higher recession probability, consumer sentiment has risen along with it. I want to remind all our listeners, make sure you don't miss out on this special deal for signing up for YCharts. If you visit go.ycharts.com/moneytree and start a free trial, all you need to do is mention MoneyTree to receive 20% off if you sign up within the next month. That's 20% off if you mention MoneyTree. So now onto the panel portion of our show. That was a great interview with Chris Mackey. I love having people like him on the show because he really kind of opens your mind to different innovative thoughts that are kind of outside the box, stuff we don't usually hear from the traditional media. You know, in the traditional media, you get one side versus the other side, and they really pit each other against each other, and they don't give you any more thought than the two that they give you. So I really love giving these alternative approaches because it makes us think outside the box and come up with maybe better solutions that aren't being talked about. So I want to get into the panel portion. So this week we have Megan Gorman. How are you doing, Megan?
Hi, Kirk. I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm excited to have you guys on. This is good. And I know you're excited to have your thoughts too, Megan. So also we have Barb Freeberg. How are you doing, Barb?
Good morning. Doing great. Thanks a lot, Kirk.
Good. And also we have Miranda Marquit. Hey, Miranda.
Hey, excited to be here.
We have a good panel today, and hopefully we have some interesting commentary here from our panel. We had a little pre-show conversation about this, and I think you'll all enjoy this. So let's start with, we talked a lot about the trade wars and global trade, tax policy, and you know, I'm sure some people kind of went to sleep with that, but let's talk about generally how this impacts investors, because I think this is interesting conversation, but this is an investment podcast, and people want to know, how does this impact my investments? So let's start with tax policy in general. Like, what does this kind of tax policy or the changes in tax policy mean to investors? I'm going to start with Miranda.
Oh, good Lord. The way tax policy affects investors really depends on a lot of different factors, right? It depends on what your marginal tax bracket is right now. It depends on tax shields or steps you've taken to protect yourself against taxes or reduce your tax liability already, and then what you're capable of doing in the future. So it's really hard to say, because the impacts that tax policy have on investors really depends on where you sit, where you're at. It depends on things like, well, how much of your income is coming from your investments right now? How much is still coming from your earned income? All of those things kind of mix together. So it's really hard to say like how tax policy is going to impact you. But one way that tax policy and maybe tariff policy and global trade policy is going to impact your portfolio is the way that the market responds to these things. Whenever tax policy is announced, whether a Fed rate is announced, whenever tariffs are announced. I mean, we've seen just in the last couple of months how, and the Dow is a terrible measure of economic performance because it's, you know, but we've seen, right? But we watch the Dow, right? We pay attention to that. And if you're watching it, you've seen how it is making wide swings depending on the day sometimes. If the president said trade talks are going well and we'll have a deal any day now, then stocks go up. And if he comes back and says, like he did the day before we're recording this, and says, oh, well, maybe we don't have a deal after all, then the Dow plunges. Part of that, too, is saying, okay, so I'm an indexer. So for me, it's having an iron stomach and getting through the volatility and the uncertainty. And I know for you, Kirk, it's about having alternative assets that aren't going to be as susceptible to these swings in the stock market. So that's another thing to consider because so many people, the vast majority of their portfolio is in stocks, it's in their 401k, and it can be very nerve-wracking to watch that, especially now toward the end of the year where people are like, should we rebalance? Let's look at our 401k, let's see how things are going. And seeing a wide swing like that can just be very nerve-wracking. That, I think, is the big impact a lot of people see in their day-to-day lives from tax policy or trade policy or any other type of policy is the way the stock market responds and then what happens to their portfolio as a result.
That's a great point because how the stock market responds is ultimately whether things matter or not in your investments because none of us are smart enough to know all of the impact. I mean, there are people who spend millions of dollars dealing with research on all these different topics and they're right or they're wrong, but the markets are ultimately the arbiter of who's right. Megan, what are your thoughts on kind of what all this means for investors?
It's funny, when I listened to the show, I actually focused a lot on when he talked about things such as wage growth, because to me, that's really an important metric that I focus on in terms of the health of the economy. What these tax cuts and the TCJA were supposed to do on the corporate side was to encourage companies to go in and do more hiring and more infrastructure investing. And I think what we saw is that that didn't really happen as much. We saw a lot more of things like stock buybacks. So for investors, that might have been a good thing. But in the long term, for the average American, a lot of what he was pointing out goes to a bigger issue, which is this idea of a third of the country financially struggles. And without wage growth, they will continue to struggle. And financial frailty is the inability to meet an emergency need. And usually we use it in the personal finance world as someone who's unable to meet a $400 expense, an emergency expense. And I think that what you've seen is, despite everything that the government has done, you have seen the fact that many Americans continue to struggle because there isn't wage growth in the country. And so they aren't able to keep up. And so, I mean, the investment market, if we think about it, it's really for the upper middle class and the wealthy in this country. The lower income Americans don't have much engagement in the investment markets.
And that's really important because I think a lot of the listeners to the show, I mean, certainly they're either investors currently or they're aspiring investors, but there are definitely a lot of people who are just getting by day to day and they're doing okay, but they're not thriving. So I think that's really important. What about your thoughts, Barb?
Been a lot of conversation around tax policy and around investing. Part of the tax policy question is the government sets the tax policy in order to structure certain outcomes. They want companies to spend more. They want companies to hire more, to create more jobs and to expand. And that's why the government lowered taxes. But unfortunately, what happened was that is not the end result of the new tax law. And unfortunately, again, the tax benefits to individuals of the new tax law is pretty minor. yeah, the middle income people got maybe a couple thousand dollars more a year, but not enough to significantly impact their lives. And so what is happening is shareholders have done great these past couple of years because we've had low interest rates. And then with the tax cut, companies have turned, as was previously said, to buying back shares, which increases the value of a shareholder's existing shares. So if you own stock in your 401k or outside your 401k, you've been a happy camper. Unfortunately, all of the country is not in the boat of being a shareholder. So I think what Chris Mackey did a wonderful job of pointing out is we need policies within our country that are going to help not only the wealthy, not only the shareholders, but are going to reward what we value, which is greater employment, higher wages. There's a disconnect. So I'd like to throw this question out, not because I have an answer, but because it's important for us to discuss, which is what can we do to help not only the shareholders, but people who want to be shareholders, people just starting out who don't have a ton of discretionary money, get into the investment markets.
You know, it's funny, Barb, when you were asking that question, I was thinking back to this one section of the tax code that I always find incredibly frustrating, which is there's this great credit out there called the Retirement Savers Credit. And basically, for people in certain income bands, it ends up being a credit that you get because you funded a retirement plan, whether it's a Roth, whether it's a 401k, a 403b, or an IRA. But what I find so frustrating about the credit is that it's not really a credit that many people can take advantage of. A credit is supposed to encourage behavior. That's sort of the tax policy behind it. And so I think that what I'm sort of getting at is for credits like the Retirement Savers Credit, one, we need to make it a better credit for Americans in that wealth band, but maybe also add different types of credits. One thing that I always think about is the thing that most Americans don't have is strong financial literacy. And we talk about financial literacy a lot in the personal finance space, but truth of the matter is financial literacy is a political issue. And it's a political issue because it comes under state rules, because if a state is going to institute a financial literacy program, the biggest mistake most states make is they don't provide compensation or funding to get educators up and ready to be able to teach financial literacy. Everybody on this panel are experts in their field, but we spend our lives focused on this. It's very hard for educators to be brought up to speed, and the money isn't there to teach them at times in certain states. But I bring this up because, one, using credits like the Retirement Savers Credit can be incredibly valuable. And two, we should use the code to encourage behavior with people who are in that financial fragile income class, whether it's giving them credit for having savings, whether it's giving them credit for taking financial literacy. Giving them credit in that section of the tax code doesn't change anything in terms of tax revenues. It actually will help behavior. But that's my own personal soapbox piece of things. But I'm always amazed at how credits are sort of limited to such a narrow band when it could really help people in that area.
One thing that a lot of people miss when they changed the tax code recently, there was obviously a lot of people on the right and the left who were arguing over different things. And one thing that I think most people miss is the fact that the tax policy is really to encourage certain behavior, and there's always going to be winners and losers. They're trying to encourage one type of behavior and they're trying to discourage other type of behavior. And one of the reasons why there's so many benefits around real estate is because they're trying to encourage real estate ownership. You're never going to have everyone who's happy with any sort of change that comes about. There's always going to be people who are unhappy. Some of the carve-outs that we had affect us, but not other service businesses, which was kind of unfortunate, but it's just the nature of tax code. You got to take what you get with it. But, you know, one thing I wanted to touch on was one thing that Barb had mentioned about buybacks. One thing that I find to be a little frustrating is there are people out there who rail against stock buybacks, which in my opinion, it tends to be more of an interest rate based outcome than tax policy outcome, because there have been stock buybacks for the last, I don't know, 20 years. They've been increasing. What tends to happen is when companies don't have opportunities or when the opportunity is greater to buy back shares than it is to invest in the business. I'd say that's only partially based on tax policy. I'd say in large part it's based on interest rates and opportunities. And what a lot of these companies don't have are opportunities to invest in areas that are going to get them a greater growth than buying back their shares. I don't know what the solution is for that, or even if there needs to be one. I would say that that is a definite problem. Similar to Wall Street, when after the global financial crisis, these traders were paid huge bonuses, the argument was, well, if we don't pay them, then they leave. There's always unintended consequences for everything that's done. And I think that's one of the challenges that we see. So, Miranda, what are your thoughts on, say, something like stock buybacks in terms of the effects that has on investors? Like, what could be done to effectively make policy changes around that? Or do we actually even need to change anything around that?
I think that Barb kind of touched on this earlier when she pointed out, unfortunately, the whole system is set up for the benefit of the shareholders. And so, I mean, there has to be some sort of balance here to look at stakeholders as well. So there's a difference between shareholders and stakeholders, right? Stakeholders do include shareholders, but stakeholders also include your employees, your community, those kinds of things. And so there needs to be a look at stakeholders. And you know, you're not always going to get this cut and dry financial return on investment when you have a stakeholder view of things. But you do need to look at those things, because those stock buybacks, yes, they can boost the price of your stock. Yes, they can be very beneficial to shareholders. But at the same time, they tried to sell this tax cut as something that, oh, well, they'll hire more people, they'll whatever. And in the end, a few companies gave bonuses, but at the same time they were giving bonuses, many of those companies turned around and fired a bunch of people too. They laid a bunch of people off. So they made this big hoopla over giving a one-time bonus, but they don't have long-term policies designed to actually support stakeholders. And quite frankly, it's like, I always go back to classic Office Space. They're talking about getting laid off so that so-and-so's stock options can go up 0.25%. Do we need that in our society? Do the shareholders really need that much? Do we need to look at a society where we take into account stakeholders as well, you know, stakeholders as a whole, and not just focus on shareholders only?
May I jump in here?
Go ahead, absolutely.
Because that is a global question that is going around in the efficient investment market ethos. And companies are created to solve a problem for people and to create profits. Companies are not created to be common good social service agencies. So although I empathize with, and I actually obviously brought it up, with the plight of people that are not shareholders, but I do not think the solution is more government intervention to make companies more social minded. I think there is another solution. And capitalism has been shown to benefit societies as a whole. And although there's the debate between capitalism and socialism, the United States is on the side of capitalism. We believe it's better for everyone, but that means people are going to be left behind. Now, I don't like that. I don't think any of us like that. So I think the solution for that, or one of the solutions for that, is not let's make companies more socialist and more concerned about stakeholders, because that's not what they're designed to do. I think the idea is a little bit back on, let's create more education, financial literacy. Let's also give all people an opportunity to get into the investment class. And I think that's a better way to be clearer on growing a capitalist society so that it can lift other people up. And I'm not going to stop here because I have ways to do this. For example, when someone joins a company, and this idea was posited in the book Nudge, where it's the idea of make choices that are good for you easier to accomplish. So a company will automatically opt a new employee into the 401k. So if they don't want to participate, they have to take an action to opt themselves out, making it easier for them to become the shareholder class. Additionally, a lot of new companies have sprung up that have these little apps that could get people into investing with not hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars, but $10, $50. And so I'm not saying investing in the markets is the best, the be-all, end-all, but over time, that is a superb way to create wealth. And so these little apps, you know, like Acorns or like M1 Finance, which is one of my favorites, can get people invested with really small amounts of money. Now, that can have a problem if you don't have the financial literacy behind you to understand that stock markets go up and down. And this investing isn't something to take lightly and think, oh, I'm going to make a killing, but rather a way of growing your wealth that is a long-term plan for 10, 15, 20 years.
I wasn't saying that like companies need to stop making a profit. I am saying, we do need to say, what do we expect from our companies? I worked briefly for a startup company that really focused on taking care of its employees. And the result of that, they had more of a stakeholder view of things. And as a result of that, they took care of their employees really well. They did good in communities. They gave us money to donate to local community causes and did all this kind of stuff. And they still managed to be extremely profitable. They managed to be bought out by another company for tens of millions of dollars. And everybody got kind of a piece of that. So I guess more I'm looking at it in terms of, it's not just about the profitability of the shares, but if we, and it doesn't have to be, you know, whatever, but can we get to a point where we say, okay, what is capitalism actually doing for us as a whole, and who is it benefiting, and can we make it benefit more people?
Sure. And it's not binary. It's not all or none. And there has been research shown, actually, Miranda, that companies that are better for their employees are more profitable.
And for reference, the book Nudge is by Richard Thaler and Cass Sustine.
Thank you. Yes, it is a wonderful book. Everyone should read it.
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes. It is a great book. And I will say, I agree with you, Barb. I mean, in a capitalist society, certainly you know, there's a freedom of choice. And I've read a lot of research recently just about leadership and running companies. And a lot of the research is showing that if you look compared to like the 80s, 90s, when it was very cutthroat and it was the Wall Street movie, you know, greed is good. And that kind of defined the era. And we're in a different era now, and that's not what people are looking for. People are looking for a good work-life balance. They're looking for a good work environment, a company that's doing good for other people and communities. But I think ultimately, just like with government, we can't rely on companies or the government to do it for us. While it's a good idea for them to encourage people with giving opting out, or I guess I would call that friction, making it frictionless to do certain things. You know, while it's nice that they do that, we can't rely on it. I think ultimately it comes down to a personal responsibility that if we want to do good, that it comes to each one of us to do it ourselves and not rely on other people. Because I think the government is a poor arbiter of what is in the best interest of the people. I think it's up to all of us to make that choice. And, you know, if we make the best choice, then as a society, we move forward. And that's just kind of my two cents. But when we talk about these issues of tax policy or global trade, and right now global trade has been in the news for going on a few years and probably will continue as long as the president's in office, because that seems to be his real primary focus. You know, how does that affect the concept of like market frailty? What does that do for investments? Is that a net positive, or what are your thoughts on this, Megan?
I think on the interview, he talked about this, where he said that a lot of this trade turmoil is a long-term game. He used, for example, the cars in China, right? That there's a 25% tariff when an American-made car is sold, but there's a 2.5% when a Chinese-made car is sold. I think the thing is, for investors who are apprehensive about the trade war and the impact on their portfolio, what you have to keep in mind is the basics of investing, which is you're investing for the long term. You should be investing in something that gets you diversified. Usually for most Americans, a target retirement fund or a robo-advisor is often the best solution. And I think it's more about not looking when you feel that there are macro concepts that are going to be causing volatility in your portfolio. I think for those of us who work with people who have significant assets, we can use those moments to, you know, take advantage of opportunity. But for most Americans, you don't want to feel that your portfolio is frail or that you're putting yourself at risk. So it's going to be a buy and hold approach and just don't look.
Good advice. What are your thoughts, Barb?
I love what Megan said. I love it because...
Thanks, Barb.
Look, I've been in the investing world for more decades than I'd like to put out publicly.
That's one decade for reference.
Yes, one decade with a lot of wisdom really, really funneled into that decade. But investing in the stock market is not for any money that you need within the next 5 to 7 years. So if you are saving for a down payment on your house, do not put money in the stock market for that because the stock market is too volatile. Yes, we all look at the long-term averages. Oh, wow, 9% over the past, you know, 7,500 years, 10% over the last 10 years. And we go, wow, I'll put my money in today for the down payment I need on a house in 2 years and it'll grow by 20%. No, it will not. That's a long-term average. So my point is, first of all, once you've got that understood and you know that money that you're investing in the stock market is for your future, it's for retirement, it's for your young child's college education, then set up a sensible investment plan. Like Megan suggested, invest in a robo-advisor, invest in a target date fund, pull up a couple of index funds that are diversified, an all-world index fund, a U.S. diversified index fund, and even a bond fund, even though the rates are kind of low because they're not going to stay like this forever. And then you don't have to look at it. Literally, you don't have to look at the value. I mean, yeah, look at it every 6 months, look at it every year, and maybe every year or so, rebalance it back to your initial preferred allocation. But that's enough. Investors who tend to look at and trade in their portfolios more regularly typically have lower returns.
I love this. When you take a step back and think about it, I mean, that's how most ordinary people are going to get started. I am the very definition of a non-expert who uses investing to reach her goals. And I did that. I've started with robo-advisors. I started with a very small amount of money each month. I started with $100 a month. And that's not enough to retire on in 20 years, but it's enough to get started. And I think that's where the regular person has to start.
And actually, I have to give a shout out to you, Miranda, because I don't even remember how many years ago you had me on an old podcast you used to do. And we were talking about, surprise, surprise, investing. And you mentioned that you invested with Betterment. And I was like, okay, I kind of know what these robo-advisors are. What's the big deal? Flash forward, you know, what, 5+ years? And turns out that Betterment, one of the top robo-advisors in terms of assets under management, makes it so easy and it is so cheap. And by cheap, I mean the management fee is just super low. And there's so many ways to invest which allow your money to go directly into the markets and not pay a big management fee to a company. If listeners can get nothing else out of this episode, and believe me, I thought the Solutionomics conversation was brilliant, and I think his book sounds fabulous. But for ordinary investors that are kind of on the fence, like Miranda said, just get started with what you can afford now. And years later, you will be very happy that you did.
That's great commentary, because I think there's a lot of people, you know, are struggling to figure out where to start to invest and what are the best strategies. And we get that question a lot, like, what's the best strategy for me? And I don't know that there's really a best solution for everybody, but what Barb and Miranda just said is probably the closest thing to it for the common people that may not want to put a whole lot of time and effort into investing because that's just not what they do for a living, which is probably the vast majority of the public out there. But, you know, I think it's a great strategy. But, you know, when you're talking about global trade or tax policy, is, you know, you need to think about what are the things that we can affect and what are the things that we can't necessarily affect. There are things that we may not have control over. Interest rates, certainly somebody has control over, but interest rates play a big part of this, which I think don't get enough airtime in terms of the impact on both global trade as well as tax policy. But interest rates are impact a lot of different things. And from my perspective, I look at it and say some of these challenges we face are because we have the low interest rates that we have. Now, you could argue it's a chicken or egg problem. Do interest rates cause the problems, or do the problems cause low interest rates? I don't know that I have an answer for that, but I know that having low interest rates does cause some systemic problems, which hopefully don't get too large in the upcoming years. But I do suspect that will present a challenge. But in general, the points that Barb and Miranda made are very strong. When we come down to the topic of risk management, it's really important. We're at the tail end of a bull market, which could last another few years or it could end tomorrow. But it's really important to assess risk and understand the risk you're taking. If you can't sleep at night with a 1% or 2% change in the stock market, maybe you should have less in the stock market. So just consider the risks you're taking and what that means to you. And if you feel comfortable sleeping at night with the volatility that comes from news that comes out here and there with, you know, a tweet about things are going well with China or not, but ultimately that's going to happen. And that's not something we have control over. So we need to focus on things that we can control, and that's our portfolios. So, Megan, where can people find more about you?
Sure. You can find me at www.thewealthintersection.com or on Twitter at Wealth Intersect.
Great. We'll look forward to having you on next week, Megan, and glad to have you part of this conversation.
Thanks, Kirk. Have a good week.
Barb, what about you? Where can people find more about you?
Just so happens you can find me at Robo Advisor Pros, where we cover everything robo advisors, from reviews to education to news and everything in between. Again, that's Robo Advisor Pros.
Great. And thanks for coming on, Barb.
My pleasure.
And Miranda, what about you? Where can people find more about you?
You can find me at MirandaMarquette.com, where I write about investing and freelancing and living the life you want with the help of the money you make. But I do have a great resources section where I talk about what tools I use to manage my own money so that I can meet my lifestyle goals.
Nice. Well, thanks for coming on, Miranda.
And thanks for having me. It's always fun to be here.
And for all the listeners, you can find all three of our panelists here every week on Money Tree Investing. So to wrap up, my name's Kirk Chisholm. I'm a wealth manager at Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can also find me every week here on the show. So that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us on Money Tree Investing Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On the website, you'll have access to all our resources, show notes, archive shows, and references for books that we talk about on the show. Lastly, please leave show ratings, comments on the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate the show, it allows us to get better access to some of the top guests that you're going to want to hear. We have some great guests coming up in the next few weeks, so tune in to hear what they have to say as well. So have a great week ahead, and remember, no one will care about your money like you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.